Hey guys, welcome to Fitness Mentor's presentation of Chapter 11, our audio lectures from the ACE Personal Trainer Manual, 5th edition. My name is Eddie Lester, and let's go ahead and get started as we look to page 392. And specifically, this chapter is called Cardiorespiratory Training, Programming and Progression. So the main point of this chapter is to really understand some basic concepts around how to program a client's cardiorespiratory exercise. And a lot of times with our clients that want to focus on things like weight loss or general health, we want to include a cardiorespiratory training program for them on top of their resistance training program, just to increase caloric expenditure, as well as there's a host of other benefits that's associated with performing cardiorespiratory training. So one of the elements that you really get to focus on here is just understanding, you know, what is the amount of times per week that someone should do cardiorespiratory training? What is the number of minutes that they should be doing? And then also understand the reasons behind, you know, how does somebody increase in cardiorespiratory endurance and all factors like that. So in the left-hand column on page 392, they just kind of talk about the adaptations, maybe, you know, what composes a workout session, the guidelines associated with a cardiorespiratory training session, everything from frequency, intensity, duration, and exercise progressions. Then the types of cardiorespiratory exercise, as well as how you integrate it into phase 1 through 4 in the ACE-IFT model. And then just some basic considerations around youth and adults. So, yeah, let's go ahead and start on page 392. And specifically, they're going to just kind of start off by introducing the main point around why people typically perform cardiorespiratory training and the benefits to it. And they basically say that the diseases of civilization can be kind of we'll say prevented with healthy lifestyle, and healthy lifestyle includes performing cardiorespiratory activity. So the cardiorespiratory activity decreases the likelihood of diseases of modern civilization. And as we move over to page 393, they're going to start to get into the adaptations associated with performing cardiorespiratory exercise. So the first kind of system that it talks about, and this is a key concept, and I do want you to highlight some of this stuff in here. The muscular system also gets adaptations when performing cardiorespiratory fitness training, because the work that is being performed is done so by the muscles, and those muscles are adapting to the type of activity that is being performed. So specifically, what I want you guys to know is the difference between the type 1 and type 2 muscle fibers. And specifically, endurance training, or cardiorespiratory endurance training, really emphasizes the type 1 fibers. These are the slow twitch muscle fibers. And specifically, what does it increase, or what does it really focus on with type 1 muscle fibers? It increases the size and number of mitochondria within the cell. And what that does is it assists with the cellular production of ATP, which ATP is the energy source that creates all movement. So, what are some of the characteristics of type 1 muscle fibers? Type 1 muscle fibers have more mitochondria than type 2 muscle fibers, and mitochondria are energy producing organisms within the cell. I don't want to say organisms, but they are energy producing organelles within each cell, and they are kind of like the powerhouse. They create the fuel that then leads to cellular work. So because type 1 muscle fibers are better for endurance, they need more mitochondria in order to emphasize energy production and endurance. Okay, so I want you to write that down right next to the type 1 muscle fibers, and they have more mitochondria, and also adaptations to performing cardiorespiratory training increase type 1 muscle fibers' size and number of mitochondria. So those are some of the main adaptations of the muscular system. But also, yeah, there's an increase in capillaries around those muscle fibers. There's potentially a little bit of hypertrophy in the sense of you're in the type 1 muscle fibers from endurance training or cardiorespiratory training. And then when you do high intensity cardiorespiratory training, like something like interval training or sprints, that sort of stuff, that emphasizes more of the type 2 muscle fibers. The type 2 muscle fibers are considered fast twitch, and basically the adaptations that they undergo is they're going to increase the number of enzymes that are associated with anaerobic energy production, which is the short-term energy production. But basically it learns to buffer lactic acid more, as well as, and we'll get into that ventilatory threshold, lactate threshold further on in this chapter. But so those are some of the adaptations of the muscular system associated with cardiorespiratory training. All right, let's go ahead and go to the cardiovascular system. So what are some of the adaptations that occur to the cardiovascular system? What is the cardiovascular system? It's the heart, blood, and blood vessels. So the basically what I want you guys to know is this first sentence in under the cardiovascular system, and what happens, what are the adaptations that occur that increase someone's ability to when you walk upstairs and you or you're going for a run and you haven't ran in a long time and you kind of feel out of shape, or you're playing with your kids, or you're walking up some stairs and you feel out of shape, feeling in shape is due to an efficient heart. So what does an efficient heart look like? Well, when you perform cardiorespiratory training, you have the expansion of blood volume, okay? And what that is leads to is the heart muscles going to hypertrophy, meaning that the muscle of the heart actually enlarges and the chambers become bigger, and therefore the muscle wall or the muscle of the heart becomes stronger, which leads to a higher cardiac output, meaning that the amount of blood that can be pumped through the heart in a minute's time increases due to the adaptations from cardiorespiratory training. Specifically, what happens, the main thing that actually happens is a larger stroke volume, which is the volume of blood ejected from the left ventricle. The amount of blood that leaves the heart with one beat is the stroke volume, and that's actually what increases. And when you have stroke volume increases, that really allows more blood to be pumped per beat, and even if it's the same amount of beats per minute, more blood is being pumped in total. Okay, so I want you to highlight the stroke volume, the cardiac output, that first sentence, and then also the when you have an increase in stroke volume due to chamber enlargement, the resting heart rate of an individual actually drops, because let's say you need, 500 milliliters per minute. Okay, you need 500 milliliters per minute. If you have more, actually, excuse me, let's say 5,000 milliliters per minute, because that's actually more accurate, or 5 liters per minute, and someone pumps 100 liters per beat, 5,000 divided by 100 is 50 beats per minute. That is a very efficient and large stroke volume, leading to a lower resting heart rate. But let's say that same, 5,000 milliliters is needed, and the stroke volume, the blood pumped out per beat, is only 50 milliliters. That means in 1 minute to pump 5,000 milliliters or 5 liters, that has to pump double the amount, which is 100 beats per minute. Okay, hopefully that made sense if you followed me there on the math. But an increase in stroke volume actually decreases or lowers resting heart rate. And I want you to write that down next to that stroke volume, as that is an adaptation that occurs with cardiorespiratory training. And that's why if somebody has a low resting heart rate, and they are in shape, or they aren't, elderly not in shape, then that typically means that they have an efficient heart. Okay, because low resting heart rate indicates a large stroke volume. And the increase in cardiac output and an increase in stroke volume is a response to aerobic training, or to cardiorespiratory training. So that's actually going to be pretty test heavy right there. one or two questions around just the adaptations from cardiorespiratory exercises or exercise on the cardiovascular system. All right, so let's go ahead and talk about the respiratory system. What occurs in the respiratory system as far as adaptations go? The first thing we're going to kind of talk about is the breathing muscles as we move over to page 394. But yeah, so the breathing muscles are the diaphragm. That's the main one. And that one actually is, we'll say, can be consciously controlled, but actually is unconsciously performed, specifically while sleeping, to keep air moving in and out of the lungs. You don't have to think to breathe, which is a good thing. That's the diaphragm is the body's key breathing muscle. Then you have the external intercostals. Intercostal means in between the ribs. The external intercostals, tongue twister, is used during passive breathing or passive inspiration. So when I'm talking, I'm not thinking about breathing in, and my diaphragm and my intercostals are actually subconsciously or not consciously breathing for me. Okay. Then you have a group of muscles that moves the rib cage upward. Sternocleidomastoid, scalenes, and then the serratus anterior. That kind of when the rib cage is lifted, it allows for more volume to enter or more air to enter the lungs because it kind of lifts the rib cage off the lungs and the lungs fill up. And then the group of muscles that pull the rib cage back downward during a forced expiration basically forced breathing out is going to be the rectus abdominis. If you go and put your hand right on your stomach right now and you breathe out really hard, what happens? Your rectus abdominis actually activates to assist you with breathing out harder. But if you breathe out really soft, the rectus abdominis does not activate. So there is not necessarily an increase in size of anything associated with cardiorespiratory training, but the strength and fatigue resistance of the respiratory muscles improve as you perform more and more cardiorespiratory training. So therefore, the breathing becomes easier because of a stronger musculature. And a lot of times it typically does, or strong musculature leads to an increase in tidal volume, which is basically going to be the amount of normal breathing, not the entire max tidal volume. Tidal volume is just like your normal breathing volume of regular breathing. Yeah, we don't need to get into that. But there is research that shows an increase in tidal volume associated with cardiorespiratory training too. And decreases typically the amount of dead space, which is air trapped within the respiratory system. So the next sort of the key concept next here on page 394 is going to be discuss the time required for increases in aerobic capacity. So aerobic capacity is basically referring to the ability to utilize the respiratory system efficiently or more effectively and create adaptations to benefit higher work output. So as we look down towards figure 11-1, they're going to talk about the increase in exercise capacity measured in VO2 max and where the peak sort of adaptation around aerobic capacity occurs. And that's right around the 24-week mark, meaning that it typically takes about 24 weeks to see the maximal or near maximal increase in aerobic capacity, meaning the ability to perform aerobic cardiorespiratory work. But you'll notice at week 16, there's a lot of benefit in the sense of if your current baseline is at 100, you could potentially increase 20% of your aerobic capacity in 16 weeks. That means 16 or 4 months of 3.5 months of intense cardiorespiratory training that leads to 20% increase in performance around VO2 max, which a 20% increase in performance could be looked at like a decrease in your 5K time or an increase in the amount of or the length of time that you can play a sport like soccer and good things like that. So really, again, yeah, just looking at those, that's kind of important. But what you'll also notice is that as you get towards the 6th month mark, there's a nice plateau around the effects of any given type of aerobic or cardiorespiratory training. So it's important to just like a resistance training, it's important to never do the same thing or programmed cardiorespiratory training. Don't do the same thing over and over and over again, in a sense that if 1 month you might be running for cardiorespiratory training, the next month you could try rowing, and then another month you could try interval circuit training or high intensity interval training. So do different things, and that will allow for continuous benefits or properly periodized train or cardiorespiratory training that leads to or to that avoids plateau. But there is also a genetic marker in which you won't be able to get much beyond. But it is good, like any sort of training, to mix it up to make sure that you don't overdo one style of training. All right, so now looking over towards figure 11-1, top right, page 395, this is going to be referring to lactate threshold. Lactate threshold, once again, kind of there's a maximal or a significant increase all the way up through 24 weeks in which you then start to begin the plateau. And you could slowly increase lactate threshold. But lactate threshold is going to be the point at which the lactate accumulation in the blood is so high that you have to reduce the amount of work to maintain it. It's basically the highest point of sustainable aerobic activity. And if your lactate threshold is increasing, that means that you can push a little harder and your performance has increased. So keep that in mind. As we move down page 395, the physiological adaptations from steady state and interval-based exercise. Steady state cardiorespiratory training, guys, is going to be doing one thing for a set amount of time. Steady state in the sense of like, I'm going to go for a run for 30 minutes. That's steady state cardio. Interval training is going to be the, we'll say high intensity for 1 minute and resting for 1 to 2 minutes, different things like that. That's an interval style training. Specifically the duration of exercise, as we get to the middle of the paragraph right there, the duration of the exercise is going to be limited by the willingness to continue or the availability of oxygen or muscle glycogen. And this really focuses on for interval training, it really focuses on 45 seconds to 3 to 4 minutes to achieve a steady state. And this is what they call the second wind. When you're performing steady state cardio, when you're performing steady state cardio, it typically it kind of burns maybe for the first minute or two. That's kind of what they're referring to there is after the first minute or two, that's when you start to feel like you can continue that state without too much burning in your lungs and difficulty breathing. You know, it's not too, as hard. So that's what they're referring to. But one thing I do want to point out is that with the adaptations associated with cardiorespiratory training, specifically around steady state cardio and oxygen uptake, heart rate, cardiac output, ventilation, blood lactate concentration, and body temperature are going to reach a stable amount. But one of the adaptations that isn't quite really mentioned that I want to point out that might be a test question is that steady state cardio, like running or like cycling, one of the adaptations that occur is going to be an increase in blood cell count, and specifically red blood cell count. That's going to be an adaptation that I want you guys to write down and associate with any sort of cardiorespiratory training program, from a running program, cycling program, swimming program. The body is going to increase red blood cell count because red blood cells carry oxygen through the body, and if you need more oxygen delivery, the body's going to adapt by increasing the red blood cell count because that's what carries more oxygen. So as we move down to the key concept, at the bottom of page 395, They're going to get into more of what I was referring to earlier, which is the interval-based exercise or the interval training. And what interval training is it's going to be a few repetitions of high-intensity, we'll say, exercise, followed by a recovery period of X amount of time. And so you go really hard for a certain amount of time, and then you relax for a given amount of time. And this bacon, my favorite breakfast food, and also the guy that did this study, is referring to the fact that it promotes a higher improvement to VO2 and aerobic capacity than steady state cardio. Okay, so basically what they're saying is that people that perform interval training typically achieve higher VO2 maxes or higher aerobic capacities in a shorter amount of time. So the main thing, though, about that, or that is very time effective, because you might be able to get a whole cardiorespiratory training program done in only 10 to 15 minutes as opposed to 30 minutes of steady state cardio. So time-wise, that's a good thing. But you always have to be aware of if your client is able to recover from high-intensity exercise and then go back or, you know, perform interval-style training because it is very high-intensity. So steady-state cardio is always recommended for those beginning clients that are more out of shape and haven't been working out for a while. But if you have a client that is in great shape, an athlete, or just someone that's been working out for a while, you can give them interval training as cardiorespiratory training, and that would actually lead to further developments or greater improvements in aerobic capacity than steady state. Okay, so keep that in mind. Is it also it's shorter, it's more effective, and yeah, it doesn't take as long to do. So that can be motivating for a client. All right, and one thing I do want to point out is that the adaptation is going to, or at the very last sentence, just basically says that the adaptation is going to allow that person to sustain higher intensities for longer durations. And really, this is kind of the point and the goal behind CrossFit. So CrossFit's goal is to create multimodal, but that's just hard to say. But basically, they want you to be efficient at all different types of exercise. So from weightlifting to endurance, running, swimming, paddling, biking. Actually, I don't know if they do biking, but they have definitely done swimming as well as paddling, I've seen. Running, they always do. And the main goal behind CrossFit is to achieve highest intensities in the shortest amount of time and or the most work in the shortest time period. That creates what they believe to be the most effective and most in shape person. And in my opinion, the people at the CrossFit Games that are like the best CrossFitters in the world are legitimately some of the best athletes in the world. Because, well, the training is so intense that their ability to get through those workouts is amazing. And, you know, a lot of people really specialize in sport and are really good at one sport, and that's how most professionals are. But with CrossFit, you're literally taking a lot of different elements from a lot of different sports and creating a competition around who's in the best shape. So if you really enjoy, you know, pushing yourself to be the most fit you could possibly be, and, you know, utilizing a social environment such as a CrossFit gym to do that, I would recommend that you give that a try. Even though you are studying to be a personal trainer, CrossFit gyms hire personal trainers with an ACE certification, so that can definitely work. But if that's your style and you want to compete against others and push yourself to be in the best shape possible, definitely check that out. Do a month, try 2 months or so, and it really, you'll understand the benefits. Just obviously, if you don't have effective proximal stability with proximal mobility and core control balance stabilization, You obviously would want to be careful to make sure you don't get injured. That's one of the trickiest points about CrossFit is that not all gyms, but some gyms do not prepare the client before they give them very difficult high intensity workouts. Some of the CrossFit gyms are extremely good at building the person up slowly to make sure that they don't push them beyond what they're used to. But out of the people that I know that aren't in great shape, they go to do CrossFit, they see great results, but then they end up injured within a 2 to 5 month timeline. Just be aware that you have to work on the core postural, specifically around the lumbar spine, thoracic spine, shoulders, well, and calves, pretty much the whole body, the kinetic chain. But yeah, about half of the people that I know that got really into CrossFit that had never done it before ended up injured within 2 to 5 months. Just be aware of your body. Listen to it as far as the lifts go, if there's pain, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, let's go ahead and move on before I get too deep down the rabbit hole. All right, moving over to page 396. They're going to continue to talk a little bit more there about high-intensity interval training. And high-intensity interval training is going to be, once again, a little bit more focused on type 2 muscle fibers. And basically going to be intense, more power-driven, we could say. But like sprinting is a great high-intensity interval training. Certain agility drills or ladders and the explosive land sports can be really good for performing that high intensity interval training. So as we get down to the middle of page 396 and talk about the components of a cardiorespiratory workout program, I don't need to get too deep into this. I'm just going to point out some quick things as we go through. But yeah, what is a cardiorespiratory workout session made of? It is made up of the warm-up, the conditioning phase, and the cool-down phase. Three phases, pretty simple. The warm-up should last about 5 to 10 minutes and slowly increase in intensity in order to get the tissues of the body prepared. But it shouldn't be so demanding that it affects the actual work period or the conditioning phase, so be aware of that. And one quick thing when the expand your knowledge says, should the client stretch during the warm-up? Basically, they should, in my opinion, if they have postural imbalances, because postural imbalances could lead to a potential for injury during the conditioning phase. So yes, in that sense. But what they're going to kind of point out is that it potentially could lower force production and we'll say not be as beneficial before. But I'm really along the lines that if somebody has a muscular imbalance, they need to stretch that no matter what before they begin any exercise in order to put the joint in the proper positioning to avoid injury. And really what they're going to say at the end of this expand your knowledge as you move over to page 397 is that the static stretching is going to be beneficial for athletes that require flexibility for their sports, like gymnastics or dance, to where athletes that don't require as much flexibility, such as like running, jumping sports like basketball players or football players or volleyball players, it may not be recommended as it could decrease total force output and decrease total performance. So that's one thing that they point out. I'm definitely along the lines of if a muscle imbalance is present, they must stretch, otherwise they're increasing their risk for injury of that joint. Especially if you're doing high intensity interval training where you're jumping, cutting, sprinting, all that stuff. So the conditioning phase is next, page 397. The conditioning phase is basically going to be the work phase. This could be the steady state cardio, this could be the interval training, or any modality that you choose. And this is where the cardiorespiratory adaptations are attempting to take place, in a sense that you're looking to create overload within the conditioning phase to ensure that adaptations occur. If it's really easy and the person's been doing it for a long period of time, the adaptations might not occur as there's not enough overload. But as we look further down the page, They say that higher intensity intervals of 15 to 30 seconds in interval training can effectively recruit type 2 muscle fibers. And that's the really high intensity, like we're talking sprints, explosive sort of jumping, or, you know, a speed, agility, and quickness elements to cardiorespiratory training. When you're looking at that 15 to 30 seconds of short, powerful, quick work, that's more type 2 muscle fibers. Whereas if you're moving more towards the steadier state or longer interval training, that's where you're going to get a mixed bag of type 2 and type 1 muscle fibers that are a little bit more emphasized. But let's say somebody has a sport that relies heavily on type 2 muscle fibers, you probably would want to give them more interval-based training in order to create the emphasis or the adaptation on the type 2 muscle fibers and that gets the heart rate up. So they're exercising, they're improving their cardiorespiratory fitness because their heart rate's getting through the roof, and they're also increasing their, we'll say, force or power output or energy production of the type 2 muscle fibers. All right, moving over to page 398, the cool down. Very similarly, you want to just do like 5 to 10 minutes of a low to moderate light intensity activity, working from a higher state to a easier state or harder state to an easier state. And what this mainly does is it's going to prevent the pooling of blood in the extremities. And this is really important as you age in more 50, 60, 70, 80-year-old people, as the ability for the body to return blood to the heart is a little bit more difficult as you age. Venous pooling of blood does not typically occur would affect someone when someone is in that younger, youth to 30-year-old age. But if they are extremely out of shape, you would definitely want to make sure that they perform a cool down effectively. Also, stretching can be great in the cool down. Foam rolling can be great, improve flexibility, focus on releasing adhesions, and improving mobility can be great too. So, what are some of the general guidelines associated with cardiorespiratory exercise? 398, as we move down there. This is pretty much simple. We talked about it already. You can highlight it if you want, but I've said this about 10 times during these lectures. How much is recommended by the Surgeon General? How much is recommended by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services? 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity aerobic activity, okay? That's the main one that you need to know. Also, 75 minutes of vigorous intensity activity can be equally good. They throw out some of the bullet points right there, but yes, health benefits are greater. Perform bouts of exercise lasting more than 10 or more minutes. Don't sell yourself short of 10 minutes during steady state cardio or just cardio in general. Also participating in strength training for 2 days per week of all muscle groups is great. And 60 minutes of moderate to vigorous intensity activity for kids, and a minimum of 3 days per week, and also muscle strengthening and bone strengthening activities 3 days per week as well. So kids, they recommend that they get out and play for sure. One thing I want to point out that will most likely make it on the test, I want you to highlight this, is that the acronym that they use for cardiorespiratory programming. So this is FITTE, and you're going to see that at the bottom of page 398 in that bottom paragraph. The acronym basically, or FITTE, means frequency, intensity, time, type, and then enjoyment or enjoyable. And we're going to go over those in just a second, but I want you to highlight that because you will be asked what those mean, the FITTE, as well as what is it used for, and it's used for cardiorespiratory exercise programming. Okay, and also the progression should be a part of that too, in a sense of FITTE, but then also just kind of think that progression is also involved, because not only are you choosing the frequency, intensity, time, type, and duration, there should always be a progression through that, through the weeks or the months that that this type of training is being performed. So, yeah, progression, and they kind of put that down in the very bottom paragraph, second sentence there. The rate of program progression depends on the client's health status, but progression should be thought of as a part of the FITTE model. If that makes sense. All right, but let's go over what FITTE really is, what it stands for, page 399. Frequency, so how many times per week, how many sessions per week are recommended, okay? So depending on the intensity of the exercise, they say about 3 days for vigorous or 5 days for moderate, and or a combination should be 3 to 5 days if you do both. So most people do moderate, so this is why 30 minutes per week of 5 days per week equals 150 minutes, and that's what's recommended by the Surgeon General or by the USDHH. Yes, United States Department of Health and Human Services. So, that's what Table 11-1 is referring to. How often should someone work out? About 3 to 5 days per week of cardiorespiratory activity. Three, in my opinion, is completely fine, especially if it's combined with 3 days a week of resistance training. All right, intensity. So intensity is going to get a little intense, and no pun intended there. But there are hundreds and hundreds of ways to measure intensity, and they're gonna go over the next maybe 15 pages on just intensity. And I don't need to get too deep into that. Okay, so I'm going to run through this a little bit more quickly. So follow along if you can. I will point out anything that's important to the test if it shows up. There's not too much that's specifically important. So how can you measure intensity? On bottom of page 399, you have heart rate and then percentage of maximal heart rate. That's your MHR. And then your heart rate reserve. Don't even worry about it. Not typically asked on the test. The RPE scale, this is your Borg scale or your 1 out of 10 scale or your 6 through 20 scale. We went over that in a previous chapter. Your VO2 max or metabolic equivalence, you're not really going to be working with that in the field too much. Maybe if you're in an exercise physiology laboratory, maybe a little bit of VO2 max for submaximal testing with specific clients that care about that sort of thing, like endurance athletes. Okay. The talk test, VT1, I like that test. We'll go over that in detail as it comes up. And then blood lactate, VT2, probably aren't going to deal with too much. But first one is going to be heart rate. Heart rate, remember, maximal heart rate, estimated maximal heart rate, that is 220 minus age. Let's just go and highlight that because that seems to show up all over the place. But if you're looking to program cardiorespiratory activity and choose an intensity, choose the 220 minus age formula and then percentages of heart rate training. So as we flip over to page 400, there's a lot of factors that are going to go into maximal heart rate and affecting a maximal heart rate, like your genetics, your age, the modality, medications that you're on, body size, altitude also matters. But really, what we're kind of looking at with this 220 minus age is you're determining someone's maximal heart rate. And then when you do cardiorespiratory activity, you want them to stay within a percentage of their maximal heart rate. Okay, so as you look at figure 11-2, they're just going to kind of say the standard deviation for this. Just stick with 220 minus age. Don't worry about if it could be a few beats per minute off, right or left. Most people, it does fall very pretty closely to the 220 minus age mark, but they're just showing you the standard deviation, meaning the likelihood of it of 220 minus age being incorrect. Don't worry about it. They're basically saying that it's about could be 24 beats per minute off either way. If somebody has a max, a 20-year-old has a max heart rate of 200, the likelihood of it being at 200 is high, but it's not always that way. Okay, whatever. We'll skip kind of quickly over to page 401 and talk about the framework for exercise intensity with healthy adults. So this is where you get your maximal heart rate recommendation from. The percentage of maximal heart rate that a sedentary person should use, this is table 11.2, page 401, is 57 to 67%. Minimal activity, meaning they don't exercise too much, 64 to 74%. They exercise here and there, but a little bit more than the previous person, 74 to 84%. Habitual physical activity, meaning they perform a sport or they have been in the gym for a year or two, 80 to 90% of maximal heart rate. And then they're always exercising or they're athletes, they can hang out or perform 84 to 94% of maximal heart rate. That's safe zones that they should stay within or under if they fall into those categories. So that's kind of all I need to really mention from there. That's not set in stone. It's not going to be a test question, but it's kind of good just to know, you know, where you should put someone as far as the maximal heart rate. So let's say a 20-year-old comes to you and he's never exercised in his life and he's not, out of shape and overweight. He's poor fitness classification. He should be in the 57 to 67% of heart rate max. So 200 times 57% is going to be 114 beats per minute. And then 67% is going to be 134 beats per minute. So, did I do that right? Yeah, 114 to 134 is his exercise heart rate range. But you wouldn't really want to go above that for safety. Hopefully that kind of made sense and you followed my math there. Another popular method they say is the Carvonin method. I don't even really want to bring this up. You don't need to be doing more math than you need to, especially in front of a client. And the Carvonin method ends up being around, you know, 4 to 6 beats per minute off. And that, in my opinion, is not a big enough spread to use the Carvonin method. But what does it do? Basically, the Carvonin method is maximal heart rate, but it takes in resting heart rate as a factor. Basically, what it's saying is that if somebody has a higher resting heart rate, they probably aren't in that great a shape, so therefore it's going to lower the maximal heart rate. That's kind of it. So you see that with a person that as you look on table 11-3, the person's resting heart rate is 50 versus the person's resting heart rate is 80. Your heart rate reserve is going to be maximal heart rate minus resting heart rate, and then multiply it by the desired intensity, which is 60% of heart rate reserve, which gets you 84 and 66, and then you add those together to get a different heart rate range for someone training at 60% of desired heart rate reserve. Or you could just say, hey, you have 190 beats per minute maximal, let's just put you at 60% heart rate, and that would put you somewhere around the 120 beats per minute ish. What's 19? Yeah, I'm not going to do the math there, but it's very similar. So it's, in my opinion, and to tell the truth, when someone's doing their heart rate training, they aren't going to be like trying to stick to one beat per minute. They're going to have a range, and if you're within the range of, you know, 120, 130 beats per minute, and the heart rate reserve that you did, you know, a little extra math for is telling them to be at 134 to 146, then, I mean, it's not a huge, huge difference. And I would, to tell the truth, just for ease of use, due to 20 minus age, and then percentage of the desired intensity that you want. And as we move over to 402, you have figure 11-3, which talks about the Carvonin heart rate reserve method, and they can kind of give you another example there of some math that you don't need to do. All right, the heart rate reserve doesn't reduce the error, or slightly reduces the error in the estimation, and that's because it takes into account the resting heart rate. But, you know, resting heart rate can vary by 5 to 10 beats per minute, from lying to standing, and even sitting, and the time of day, and lots of different things. So, yeah, 220 minus age is great for you. Next, we are going to look at rating of perceived exertion. And specifically, the rate of perceived exertion is referring to the difficulty that someone places on a certain activity. And you can use a 0 to 10 scale or a 6 to 20 scale. The 6 to 20 scale is called the Borg scale. I want you to know that. 6 to 20 scale is the Borg scale. Borg scale, once again, I think we've already gone over this, but the 6 to 20 represents the heart rate that someone is most likely at. 6 being a reference for 60, as far as when someone's not doing any activity, their heart rate's at rest, it's about 60 beats per minute. And then, 6 to 20, if something is extremely, extremely, maximally hard, they might be at that 20, which is about 200 beats per minute. When I was 24 years old, I was in an exercise physiology laboratory and on a cycle ergometer and doing the testing, breathing into the tubes and measuring heart rate and everything like that. The highest I could possibly get my heart rate was 191 beats per minute. According to 220 minus age, I should have been able to get my heart rate up to 196, okay? But I got it up to 191, and that was as hard as I possibly could before I completely almost broke down and crashed, well, fell over. And that's pretty dang accurate in my opinion. So just use 220 minus age. That's my experience with it. But also then the RPE scale directly relates to where the heart rate might be when you're exercising throughout the, 6 to 20 or 60 to 200 scale. Just add a zero. It's kind of estimating heart rate. Okay, I think I explained that a little bit too much, but and there's a variance in between there. Next, as we get into metabolic equivalence, VO2 max and VO2 reserve, 50%, 40% of VO2 max, don't even worry about it. I wouldn't even stress to learn it at all. Then getting into the bottom of page 403, the expand your knowledge section, just kind of goes into a little bit further understanding of the zero to, or the set or the session RPE. And this is basically just going to be the monitoring the combined intensity and duration of the exercise session. And you get a 0 to 10 scale. But the main thing is that they consider it an effective programming and monitoring tool is going to monitor the intensity and create ownership of a program. And they get a point system or scale for completing a total exercise intensity for a certain amount of minutes. And as you flip over to page 404, they're going to get into that, and then you get this scale. You could use that if you want. You could read a little bit further into it. Seems a little bit overbearing, in my opinion. Doing cardio is kind of doing cardio. If you have a client that needs parameters because they are an endurance athlete and they're professional at it, yes, you can use certain things like this. But in all reality, staying at 60% of max heart rate for 30 minutes three times a week is a great starting point that someone can do it, and they don't need, all they need to do is monitor their heart rate a little bit every 5 to 10 minutes, put their hands on the treadmill or row machine or whatever they're using to check that. All right, as we move over to page 405, we're going to talk a little bit about ventilatory threshold. And specifically, I just want to point out that the lowest training intensity in which adaptations can occur is VT1, ventilatory threshold 1. Okay? And this is where breathing increases to a point that you can't talk very easily. So that's basically ventilatory threshold 1. That's when you start to have to breathe heavier because you're exercising. That's VT1. Okay, and it's basically the point at which your heart rate increases to the point where your breathing must significantly increase enough. Okay, we don't really need to go over much more there, but yeah, it's just basically referring to. I just wanted to talk about VT1 before we get into the next section. So as we move over to page 406. We can talk a little bit about MET values or metabolic equivalent values. A metabolic equivalent is basically, or yeah, MET, MET, metabolic equivalent. The METs were created to suggest how far beyond resting an activity is. And one MET is the body at rest. Okay? What's the caloric expenditure? What's the VO2 associated with that? And every MET there forward means it's twice as hard as resting. There's twice as much metabolic activity going on than rest. And then 3 METs is 3 times rest. 4 METs is 4 times rest. 5 METs is 5 times the metabolic equivalent of resting. Okay? And, you know, some of the hardest activities are going to be around that, we'll say, 10 to 12, maybe even 13 METs. And there's a lot of metabolic equivalents that they give examples of, but the body at rest, asleep, is 1 MET. And that's about all you really need to know. And yeah, I mean, if someone's a great jogger, it might not be 8 METs at 5 miles an hour. It might be a few less because they're really good at it. There's a lot of variance that goes into that as well. But the main point around METs is just to try to give your client the idea of how hard an activity is. For instance, if they run at 7 miles per hour, it's a lot harder than running at 5 miles an hour. But they probably already know that, so you don't really need to understand METs or memorize anything about METs too specifically, and especially not for the test. So next we're going to get into caloric expenditure. So the two energy sources or energy fuels for the body are going to be fats and carbohydrates, and the oxygen is going to be used, or oxygen consumption is used with those fats and carbohydrates to produce energy. And you can measure the amount of oxygen and carbon dioxide inhaled, or oxygen inhaled and carbon dioxide exhaled, to get an idea of the caloric expenditure occurring. That's more exercise physiology laboratory. We don't need to do the math around it. We don't need to, estimate someone's caloric expenditure. We just need to increase someone's caloric expenditure. The cardiorespiratory machines like treadmills can give you an idea of how many calories are burned, or a heart rate monitor might give an idea of how many calories are being burned. But it gets kind of tough, and you don't want to overdo it, but you can estimate what the total amount of calories per minute for an activity can be. And you don't need to do the VO2 times body weight divided by 1,000 times 5 kcal per liter per minute. You don't need to do that math to figure that out. But if you want to be specific around how many calories are being burned, you can use this formula. And I just don't even want to get into it because it's so... You will never do this in the field unless you're working in an exercise physiology laboratory. So I guess I'm going to skip it. One thing, though, that you can use, hooray, before I get myself too depressed, is the TOC test. Page 407, the TOC test. I highly recommend using this. We talked about it before in previous lectures. But can someone complete a sentence or without taking a break in between their words? So I went to the store and I bought bananas. That person just passed the talk test. Hooray. I went to the store and I bought bananas. That person failed the talk test. Talk test is a direct representative of VT1, the point at which cardiorespiratory adaptations can occur. So if your person can talk no problem through their activity, you should probably increase the intensity. And that's kind of what this talk test section is about. Basically, the talk test works on the premise that at VT1, ventilation increases, and therefore breathing frequency increases, and they cannot complete a sentence a longer sentence with one breath. So that's the talk test. And basically one of the requirements of comfortable speech is controlling breathing frequency. So therefore, VT1, it is no longer possible to speak comfortably. That's one reason for doing the talk test is to estimate where VT1 is, and VT1 is the point at which cardiorespiratory adaptations can occur. There's enough overload for the heart to be stressed and have to pump to increase oxygen to the muscles being worked, as well as remove the waste products associated with them. And yeah, they go over the VT1 a little bit in the key concept, but in VT1, once you're at VT1, there's a nice, we'll say, continuance of VT1 until you hit what's called VT2, which is the second ventilatory threshold, and that's a metabolic marker that's, at the bottom there, 407 and over to 408, VT2 represents the point at which the intensity cannot be sustained because, waste products like lactate or CO2 begin to overwhelm the body's ability to deal with it. Okay, so this is the point at which you're running, and then you try to sprint after a few minutes of running, and you cannot maintain that sprint because the body cannot keep up with the or cannot buffer the lactate that's being produced by the muscles, and so therefore the intensity must drop. And they talk a little bit about what's called the onset of blood lactate accumulation. This is really not going to be anything that you're going to worry about, but just know that VT2 is not sustainable intensity of exercise. It's where the exercise intensity is so high that it cannot be considered steady state because you will have to drop that intensity because you won't be able to sustain it. But an adaptation of cardiorespiratory training is an increase in VT2, or what's called an increase in the lactate threshold. And the lactate threshold is the point at which the body can no longer maintain that intensity, and that's VT2. So if you ever hear someone talk about a lactate threshold and increasing lactate threshold, or basically being able to sustain higher intensities of cardiorespiratory training, or just of higher intensities in general, the lactate threshold goes up with consistent cardiorespiratory training. All right, so they talk about more about the talk test working, and it's a good indicator of VT1, and you don't need to they give you some sentences to say like the Lord's Prayer, or A is for apple, B is for boy. Okay, if you have them read a text or answer a question, and the main point is, can they speak comfortably? If they cannot speak comfortably, that means they're above VT1. And if the answer is yes, the intensity is below VT1, and then at the first response that is less than yes, that's probably means that they're above or at VT1. And if the answer is no, I cannot speak comfortably, that means they're nearing or at VT2. So there's some more talk test info for you guys to use. Nothing specific about the test there, but yeah, just some good info. Then they get into blood lactate and ventilatory threshold 2, or VT2. We kind of talked about that enough, so I don't really need to get into it. But there's one thing at the end of this little section on page 409, the last sort of, three sentences, is basically the need to prevent accumulation of lactate. Lactate is going to cause disturbances in the blood pH. Okay, so the body needs to attempt to balance that acid buildup, because it's lactic acid, and it's buffered by the bicarbonate buffering system in the blood. It's basically producing extra carbon dioxide, which increases the amount of breathing, and therefore the challenge to talk becomes harder. So an increase in blood lactate and VT1 occur at the same time. at about the same exercise intensity. One thing, the reason why I mentioned that is because there's, when we talked about in the previous chapter, beta-alanine buffering the acid buildup to allow for longer endurance training to occur, that is kind of what we're talking about, that blood lactate is building up and the bicarbonate buffering system is working to buffer that. But to increase VT2, meaning to assist with the clearing of blood lactate, beta-alanine, the supplement, can be taken. This is, like I mentioned, what you should include in your pre-workout if you know you're doing endurance-based training. Okay. And then in the expand your knowledge section, it gets into understanding the ventilatory response to exercise. Basically, there's going to be an increase in ventilation as the exercise intensity increases. You're going to breathe more as the work gets harder. I didn't really need to say that, but that's the main point of this little section. And you can kind of read a little bit further into that to learn more about what's going on as far as the basically hydrogen ions are building up. Blood's bicarbonate buffer system, which is HCO3? I forget what that is. Carbonic acid, CO3. So, yeah, what, dihydrogen, organic chemistry. That's not fun. So let's just skip that section. You don't need to know anything about the chemistry elements or molecules that are used in the buffering system to buffer lactate and clear it from the blood. But throwing out some chemistry at you. And as we move over to page 410, this is where the passion behind personal training gets a little bit like, you don't really need this, guys. Sorry if I'm kind of skipping around here a little bit, but you don't really need to focus too much on the how to measure intensity. It's is this difficult for you? Yes or no. Is this too hard? Yes or no. Is this about right? Yes or no. And most of the time, those questions right there will allow the client to feel or allow you, the trainer, to gauge the intensity appropriately. Okay. So let's just kind of skip through there. And actually, I want to go to the last part of page 410. Figure 11-5 kind of shows the lactate accumulation associated with heart rate and associated with ventilation. And obviously, as heart rate increases and the ventilation increases, so does lactate. And typically, it's because of the waste products that need to be cleared, ventilation increases, and therefore heart rate increases to clear all that. Okay. Key concept, bottom page 410. There's two metabolic markers, VT1, VT2, are basically the respiratory responses to blood lactate accumulation, and an easy way to divide intensity into zones. And this is where they should have just jumped straight away. But three zones of training are completely fine to use, and I highly recommend this. Zone 1 is below VT1, meaning the heart rate has increased, but it's not to the point at which breathing needs to increase. VT1 to in between VT2 is called Zone 2, and that's the point at which you can have steady state cardio occurring. And then above VT2 is Zone 3. This is typically, we'll say, interval training or high-intensity interval training that gets the heart rate way up, but it's not sustainable. So, for a brand new client, you can flirt with zone 1 and maybe push them into the beginning of zone 2. For an intermediate client, you can push them more towards zone 2 and to the higher end of zone 2, and maybe even a little bit, and probably not too often, into the zone 3. And then if you have a very conditioned client, you can push them all the way into that zone 3, which is beyond their VT2, meaning they won't be able to sustain that intensity, but it is good to do interval training because, like said before by Mr. Bacon, the interval training can increase the VO2 max more than steady state cardio. All right, and then the little blue box in the top right of page 411 simply stated, if a client can talk comfortably, They're in training zone one. If the client cannot complete the talk test, or they can talk comfortably, or they're not sure if they can talk comfortably, they're working more in zone two. And if they definitely cannot talk comfortably, that is zone three. And I kind of gave my own explanation of that. But and then they get into a little bit of the four phases and how they're associated with the three zone training system. And it's basically chronological progression, in the sense that the phase one is kind of associated with zone one, zone or beginning of zone two. Phase two is associated with end of zone one, more zone two. And then phase three, you can move into the zone three, and yeah, that's basically it. But basically, it's as the person gets in better shape, they can move into higher intensities of training. Woo, that felt like a long time just to get through intensity, and I probably went over that in even more detail than I expected, but 15 pages on different ways to monitor cardiovascular intensity is definitely not for personal trainers as much as it is for exercise physiologists or people working in a lab. Choose the simplest version to monitor intensity, and in my opinion, the simplest version is asking someone, how do you feel? Use the RPE scale. That's great. From 0 to 10, how difficult is this exercise right now? Oh, it's a 5. Okay, so let's increase it to a 6 or 7. I want you to be at a 6 or 7 for this intensity of work. And then they're going to tell you, I feel like this is at a 6 or 7 because you increased it from 5. Okay, that's pretty good. All right, next is going to be duration. Okay, so duration is going to refer to how long should somebody be performing cardiorespiratory activity. That's pretty much all you need to know. Well, more or less, but let's go ahead and go through the key concept. The duration is associated with the appropriate duration is associated with decreased mortality and decreased morbidity and improving overall fitness. The main point that you want to make sure that you do with your clients is they need to be exercising for more than 10 minutes to get the training benefits of cardiorespiratory training. If they do 10 minutes three times a day, that's completely fine, they suggest. And just for overall health, keep that in mind. All right, and what happens, the burning, we'll say 1,000 calories per week increases health parameters via cardiorespiratory exercise. Things like lowers blood pressure, lowers cholesterol. But then, if you're burning 2,000 calories a week, that's more promoting overall health, overall fitness, and weight loss. So the goal maybe for weight loss clients might be to burn 2,000 calories per week utilizing cardiorespiratory activity. So if somebody burns 400 calories in one exercise training session, they should work out 5 times per week of that amount of caloric burn to increase the likelihood of body fat loss. Okay. Moving over to page 412, I do want to point out once again that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services suggests 150 minutes of total moderate intensity activity per week. 30 minutes a day, 5 days per week. Do I need to say more? Or again, probably not. Okay. So to finish the FITTEP up, remember this all started with the FITTE, frequency, intensity, time, type, and duration. Oh wait, time, type, and enjoyment. Time is referring to duration. If I didn't say that under duration, duration is the time as far as FITTE, frequency, intensity, time, type, enjoyment. It's the time. That's what duration is. How long should we be doing the exercise? And then the exercise progression is the final sort of, we'll say, straw in the FITTE model. And I want you to remember that the FITTE does include progression because you need to progress the training in order to create or continuously stimulate overload. So they basically talk about the principle of overload and how they need enough stress to stimulate that, adaptation to the tissues of the body. And it all depends on where someone's current conditioning is to determine their overload tolerance, we'll say. So what is their conditioning level? What are their program goals? And the tolerance for the discomfort that they're doing. Okay, and then they get into a little bit of specificity, but based on what the client wants, certain exercises might be a little bit more appropriate for different clients. Clients with bad knee injuries should probably not be running for their cardiorespiratory activity. But maybe something like an elliptical, which has a very low impact, might be better. Or a row machine, which doesn't maybe put as much pressure on the knees. Or a cycling, which is pretty much zero or very, very low impact, that sort of thing. So keep that in mind. And then also, exercise duration, as we move over to page 413. Exercise duration is the most or the easiest way to manipulate or to progress initially. So the basically, if somebody does, we'll say 30 minutes of steady state cardio, the easiest progression is to say do 35 minutes of cardio, okay, or increase the session duration by 10%, or 5 to 10 minutes over the course of 2 to 6 weeks, that sort of thing, and it is important, like I mentioned before, that when you are progressing, you can think of progressing as not only doing more time or higher intensity of one activity, but doing different activities. They consider it cross training. That's why CrossFit is multimodal. I love that. And I'm sorry, whatever. Okay. Cross training is associated with doing a lot of different activities for cardio. So walking, cycling, elliptical, playing a sport, lots of different activities that you can do for cardio. So keep that in mind. And that also limits the risk for burnout or injury associated with a ton of volume of one activity. The one thing that I always refer to whenever somebody talks about burnout or orthopedic injury from too much cardio is knees on running. Okay, when you're a runner and you're running 5 to 6 days per week, the amount of impacts that occur in your knee are in the thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of impacts, and you're hitting, and if you don't have good shoes and you don't vary your training very frequently and you just continuously run and try to run further and further and further and further, your body is going to break down no matter what. Okay? Unless you're doing the appropriate things to rest, recover, maintain flexibility, take the time off, appropriate time off, and yeah, okay. So just keep that in mind. Always switch up the type of cardiorespiratory training with your clients to make sure that they don't get too much volume within one mode of training. All right, guys, so we're kind of running pretty far into this lecture. We aren't quite through this chapter, but we've got another maybe 30 or so pages. We're going to do that in the soundbar below, so take a little break, and I will see you down below as we get on with the modes or types of cardiorespiratory activity. All right, I'll see you down there. Cheers.